Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, October 23rd, 2017. I hope you know by now that I'm not a member of any of the major political parties. I'm an independent, and we're categorized here in California under the inelegant label, No Party Preference. I am an NPP voter. And so I watch with interest the machinations of both of the major dominant political parties. And over the weekend, Steve Bannon came to California to promote his disruption campaign of the Republican establishment. And they gathered in, in Orange County. And he took the opportunity in a freewheeling, script-free speech to rip into George W. Bush, who, of course, gave a speech earlier in the week where he, without naming Trump, showed all of the things that he doesn't agree with in terms of Trump himself, the way he acts, and the policies that he is promoting. So Bannon fired back that G.W. Bush conducted a presidency that was the most destructive in U.S. history. Quote, "There has not been a more destructive presidency than George Bush's." Well, what about Trump? I think he sets a new low, Steve-O. He went on to say that the Republican president had embarrassed himself. The speechwriter wrote a highfalutin speech. It's clear that Bush didn't understand anything he was talking about, and he has no earthly idea whether he's coming or going. I really think he's talking about the current occupant of the White House. But Bannon has threatened to run a well-funded opponent with all the cash he gets from the right-wing Mercer clan to kind of Breitbartize the United States Senate. And he threatens to challenge every Republican who is up in 2018, except for the knuckle-dragger Ted Cruz. He's earned a pass. And Trump himself says, well, gosh, Steve, every Republican incumbent who's up in 2018, and he said there are a few good ones who he is going to try to protect. But this is what we call internecine warfare. And it's what's preventing the Republicans from doing everything they want to dismantle not only the work of the Obama administration, but decades of progressive policies that have been hard fought and not easily won. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, there was a gathering of the Democratic National Committee members in suburban Las Vegas over the weekend. And one member of the DNC who was traveling there from the Bay Area put up a little note on Facebook that she was going, and I said, well, look, you know, I left the Democratic Party a long time ago, but please prevent or resist the plans that Tom Perez, the new DNC chair who was handpicked by Barack Obama to prevent Keith Ellison, a Sanders supporter, from grabbing the reins of the Democratic National Committee. That all occurred last fall. And I have had a lot of respect for Keith Ellison, but in this episode, he got hosed. And the proof emerged over the weekend. So in this Facebook response, I said, you know, resist the corporate types that Perez wants to put in place of the purged Sanders and Ellison supporters. I said, don't let Donna Brazile have any continuing role in the Democratic National Committee. Oh, and by the way, see what you can do to block the Perez plan to put a bunch of corporatists and lobbyists into positions where they will be superdelegates in the next presidential race. Well, none of the goals that I articulated were achieved, and it's actually worse than that. Because they formally approved Tom Perez appointments to the Rules and Bylaws Committee. And that's where the sausage really gets made, or the rules that govern the sausage creation are generated. He named a bunch of former Hillary Clinton supporters and establishment Democrats who opposed Bernie Sanders in 2016. And he, out of 30 members, not a single Sanders supporter was appointed to the Rules Committee. The appointments backtrack or renege on promises of unity from Perez, who picked four Clinton supporters on the DNC Unity Reform Commission to place on the Rules Committee. Oh, and Donna Brazile is still there, despite an effort that was echoed or amplified by BuzzFeed last week, because they lumped Donna Brazile, who's African-American, with two other Hillary Clinton supporters who are black, and said that this was a progressive attack on African-Americans. Well, Donna Brazile tainted herself as the interim chair, as the chair. And after Debbie Wasserman Schultz finally stepped down last year, we learned how Donna Brazile was part of the DNC team that tilted the playing field against Sanders. And, you know, coughing up questions about a debate for Hillary Clinton just shows how worried they were about whether Hillary could perform or not against the aging senator from Vermont. Now, let's name a few names here. In addition to Brazile, Stephen Battelle, a billionaire donor, close ally of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. He's from Florida. He was appointed by Perez. He became chair of the Florida Democratic Party under controversial circumstances in January with the help of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Former lobbyist Jeff Berman, who represented the private prison Geo Group and Keystone XL Company, along with Maria Cardona and Minion Moore, senior officials at Dewey Square Partners, who represented the predatory lender Countrywide Financial. They were appointed to the committee. Tax lobbyist Chris Liu and Frank Leone, or Leone, a lobbyist for the anti-environmental interests, were also appointed to the committee. And payback for Keith Ellison? Get this, okay? Ray Buckey, I believe, is a gay man from New Hampshire. He actually had run for DNC chair along with Perez and Ellison and a handful of others. And when it became clear that he wasn't going to win, Ray Buckey supported Keith Ellison. It was his second choice. He himself was his first choice. But he had to go. And in his place from New Hampshire, Kathy Sullivan, a Perez supporter. So this really sums it up. The Democratic National Committee is committed to Clinton-centrist corporate politics, and it has essentially signed its own sentence of irrelevance for the foreseeable future. And here's another example, all right? In Virginia, Terry McAuliffe is termed out. There is a slate of Democrats running, and one of them is a progressive African-American running for lieutenant governor named Justin Fairfax. But last week, they eliminated him from the promotional materials for the campaign. They were running as a slate. So presumably he won't be on the TV ads that promote the Democratic ticket. And why? Because he took a strong stance against oil pipelines in Virginia, which is loaded with them. So the corporate interests got a hold of the Democratic Party and they said, hey, you know, if you want pipeline cash in your campaigns this year, that guy's got to be hidden. And they actually followed through. Donald Trump seems committed to keeping alive the story of his bungled commentary that led to a bungled phone call to the widow of the late Sergeant LaDavid T. Johnson, who was killed earlier in October in that attack in the country of Niger in Africa. And part of it is because his widow, whose name is Maisha Johnson, she went on Good Morning America today and explained why the president's condolence call had offended her. He couldn't remember my husband's name. The only way he remembered my husband's name is because he had a report in front of him. And that's when he actually said, LaDavid. I heard him stumbling on trying to remember my husband's name, and that's what hurt me the most. And the defensive, thin-skinned, combative occupant of the Oval Office demeaned himself again by continuing to contradict what she said. And, of course, we saw last week John Kelly sully himself by becoming a demagogue for Trump, who then immediately undercut him, just like he does almost everybody else who tries to clean up his mistakes and who tries to stand up for his indefensible positions. And Maisha Johnson also pushed back against General Kelly's criticism of Congresswoman Frederica Wilson because she had listened in on the call. The widow said she had asked the military official, who was also in the limo with them on their way to the airport to pick up the remains of her husband, she asked that military liaison, I guess I'd call that person, to put the call on a speakerphone. So Congresswoman Wilson did not rudely or inappropriately or intentionally invade the privacy of the president's call to Ms. Johnson. And we know that General Kelly listened in on the call because he tried to explain it away when he attacked Congresswoman Wilson and the media for raising these questions. And here's a statement of class. In the ABC interview, Maisha Johnson was asked if she wanted to say anything to Trump, and she declined to deliver a message to him, because unlike Trump, she appears to have some self-control and didn't want to fuel this ugly political spectacle that is overshadowing the death and burial of her soldier husband. She did say she's desperate to know more details about the disappearance and death of her husband and why the military has insisted that his casket be kept closed. She wants to know why. And she deserves answers. And we're seeing the corporate media start to dig in. Over the weekend, there was more coverage about the events in Niger, but I can't say that it clarified things, so I'm waiting for more clear reporting before I go into any more detail about that. Well, you know how Trump hired Chris Kobach, the former Secretary of State of Kansas, the guy who ran the interstate cross-check list, the preeminent voter suppression expert of the Republican Party. He got Kobach to be the co-chair with, I almost called Mike Pence Dick Cheney, with the vice president. Well, there is a lot of dissension in the ranks. We have two members of this committee who have gone public saying, what the hell's going on and why aren't they telling me anything? The Secretary of State of Maine, Matthew Dunlop. He said it's clear he's not being made aware of information pertaining to the commission. Quote, I am in a position where I feel compelled to inquire after the work of the commission upon which I am sworn to serve and am yet completely uninformed as to its activities. He's received no information about their research or activities since its last meeting in September. A commissioner from Alabama, Jefferson County Probate Judge Alan King, said he sent a similar letter last week. The only info he's received from the commission was the death of a fellow commissioner, the former state lawmaker from Arkansas, David Dunn. Here I am on this high-level government committee, and I don't know when the next meetings are, how many meetings there will be. Well, I can imagine Chris Kobach is feverishly writing the final report, hoping to get it rubber-stamped by these other members, and I hope that they insist on being a part of the process. Now, a week ago, we were reacting to the 60 Minutes Washington Post story exposing how members of Congress, all of whom got massive contributions from the drug industry and the opioid manufacturers and distributors in particular, how they had passed a law which prevents the Drug Enforcement Agency from cracking down on the massive distribution of these highly addictive painkillers. Well, we now know that the text of the law was written by a lobbyist. And before we get to that, Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah, whose committee approved the bill, and it was passed without a recorded vote in both the House and the Senate. He said that the 60 Minutes report falsely depicted lawmakers as in the pocket of the drug industry. But the ever resourceful Li Feng, who writes at The Intercept, he got a copy of a letter from the Patient Access Alliance, a group that receives support from drug companies involved in the opioid industry. And when he just, you know, clicked on show changes or track changes, he was able to see in the metadata for the Word file that the bill, or at least key language, was written by Kristen L. Freitas, Vice President for Federal Affairs of the Healthcare Distributors Alliance, a trade group representing McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, the dominant players in the distribution of opioids. And so this just shows that the Congress is deeply in the pocket of the industry. Now, there's another story about the DEA today that deserves your scrutiny. The New York Times has used the Freedom of Information Act to get a copy of a night vision video that was shot by the DEA by agents who were conducting a raid along the Mosquito Coast, a remote part of Honduras. This occurred in 2012, May of 2012. And since then, the DEA has maintained that the video clearly shows that its agents acted properly when they shot at a canoe. Now, let me get this straight. The DEA guys were in a canoe, but they shot at a boat that killed one man, two women, and a 14-year-old boy. And they claim that they responded after shots came from the boat. But the video shows that there were likely no shots fired from the boat. An inspector general found no evidence to support the DEA's account. And it's believed that one flash of light that occurred from the boat with the Hondurans in it was the ricochet of a bullet from the DEA team. And this just shows that we can't trust these people. They will lie even when there is video evidence that contradicts their lies, and most of the time, they hope to get away with it. Now, there's another video that was published by the New York Times over the weekend that I have serious problems with. On the face of it, it looks like a worthwhile quest. They cobbled together the video recordings of gunshots at Mandalay Bay during the shooting spree alleged to be caused solely by Stephen Paddock. And they straighten out the timeline of when the security guard Jesus Campos was shot. It was either after the first burst of gunfire that Paddock fired at the crowd or right before, about 10:05. That's been the source of conflict as the sheriff in Las Vegas changed his story three different times. And the third version is in conflict with the New York Times video and the claims of the people who run the Mandalay Bay. But there are two glaring omissions, and I'm linking to this 12-minute video. You can watch it for yourselves. They break it down into a 10-minute span with 10 bursts of gunfire. They edited together sound and video from 30 different sources to put this together. But there is not a single reference to the repeated allegations that there was a second shooter. And last week, I supplied you with a link to the YouTube video of a forensic acoustics expert who says that the science leads him to conclude that there were two shooters from different places, not both coming from the Mandalay Bay. The other glaring omission is that while the Times video takes you step by step through the 12 bursts of gunfire, when the police finally got to the 32nd floor, we know that there was a delay of up to an hour before they actually burst into his room by blowing down the door. But the Times just glosses over that, and they don't put a timeline on the final sequence of events that they depict in this video. Now, we deserve to know the truth, what the actual sequence of events in the Times were, and there has been an attempt to cover up the issue of why the cops delayed busting into his room, by some accounts for up to an hour or even 72 minutes. And we're all supposed to just forget about that, you know, in the fog of it all, and who cares, and buy into the official narrative. Well, I, for one, am not prepared to do that. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like John Molitor, who just signed up for $20 a month. Thank you, John. Also, Brian Mazzi, a longtime supporter, Joe Clarici, and the very generous Paul Elsesser. I also want to point out, and conveniently I don't have the new number here in front of me, but I got a new P.O. box for various reasons. I am leaving Box 100 in Mill Valley, and I have a new P.O. box in San Rafael, and it's on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. So please, if you do want to mail me communications or a check or any kind of correspondence, please do direct it to the new P.O. box in San Rafael, California, zip code 94115. I think that's right, but double check on the page, will you? Well, you know, the New York Times has been a key promoter of the Russiagate narrative, and I've been sharply critical, along with Bob Perry and others, of the innuendo, the leaks, the anonymous sources that they have used to fuel the narrative that they've built. And they've clearly been in cahoots at times with the three different congressional committees that are looking into the Trump-Russia stuff. You've got the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the Senate Judiciary Committee. And the Times is really sad here because each one of those has its own set of issues. The House Committee has fought over Devin Nunes, who says he's recused himself, but then he insisted on the subpoenas to Fusion GPS, which I actually regard as a reasonable move, and I don't know why the other members of the committee hadn't already done it. But Fusion GPS is the Washington consulting firm that first used Republican money and then used Democratic money to pay the British former spy, Christopher Steele, who compiled the so-called dossier. And this should have been out in the open months ago, but they just got around, and Fusion GPS has largely taken the Fifth Amendment and refused to cooperate. But the Judiciary Committee looking into the firing of Robert Mueller, the FBI boss, James Comey, Mueller was his predecessor, they're getting nowhere. And the Senate Intelligence Committee also claims that it is stymied because Chris Steele won't talk to them. And so it appears to be pretty much falling apart, and they're leaving it to Bob Mueller to come up with any conclusive information based on their firmly stated assertion that Russia meddled in our election last year. You probably heard of Bill Browder. Maybe, maybe not. He's a critic of the Kremlin. He's a U.S.-born British citizen, super wealthy billionaire who at one point was the largest foreign investor in Russia. And over the weekend, Russia successfully apparently used a loophole at Interpol and placed him on an international wanted list. This is producing thundering outrage from Mike McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia and a reliable supporter of the Trump-Russia narrative. This is outrageous. Fix this now. Do not join Putin's campaign against Bill Browder. Well, Bill Browder's motives here are quite questionable. You know, he has promoted the idea that his so-called accountant, Sergei Magnitsky, uncovered a $230 million scam by Russian tax officials and then was imprisoned and died in jail. This led to the basis for the passage of the U.S. Magnitsky Act, which is sanctions on specific individuals in Russia. And I'm skeptical of Bill Browder's whole argument here. And I think he managed to successfully hoodwink key members of the U.S. Congress to get the Magnitsky Act passed. Anyway, he's on a very special no-fly list right now. Now, here is a story that really details the deep conflicts of interest of one Donald J. Trump. Because a member of the Mar-a-Lago Club, a Chinese national who is described as a tycoon, a real estate tycoon, now living in exile in New York, and he tweets a lot. He puts out a lot of information critical of the Beijing government. He was graced with illegal visits by Chinese security officials who broke U.S. law and diplomatic protocol to twice interview him in May and try to intimidate him. And this guy's name is Guo Wengui. Maybe it's Wengui, spelled W-E-N-G-U-I. At any rate, what's embarrassing here is that Trump received a hand-carried letter from Chinese officials that was delivered by Steve Wynn, the Las Vegas casino magnate and a finance chair of the Republican National Committee, who just happens to own a big casino in Macau that's regulated by Beijing. So he brought a letter to Trump in May, delivered it to Trump at a private dinner. Afterward, Trump argued that we should support the extradition or the deportation of this man, Guo. And his assistant said, "Hey, Donald, he's a member of your Mar-a-Lago club. You really want to do that?" And apparently he does. The undocumented pregnant teenager who is held at a corporate prison in Texas right now is upping the ante. She has asked a full federal appeals court of 10 judges in Washington to immediately consider her case and her demand to receive an abortion. And she's being caught up in the evangelical wars and these Trumpists who now run the prisons and run the immigration department. They're saying, well, we don't want to be facilitating an abortion. And get this. Here's an argument from the Justice Department. The woman, referred to as Jane Doe, quote, arrived here illegally and refuses to leave. She has put herself to a difficult choice. And if the federal government has to approve, assist, and be complicit in Ms. Doe's abortion, the government's interest in avoiding that facilitation outweighs any alleged burden she has created for herself. That is incredible. It shows that our Justice Department doesn't understand the Constitution, the liberty interest found in a woman's right to an abortion without undue burden, and they're claiming that if she would just leave, that we wouldn't have to deal with all this. This is really astounding. And it shows that whatever separation of church and state we used to have is being erased by the players in this administration. On Friday in our Facebook Live video feed, we got a lot of interesting comments and commentary about the causes of the Napa and Sonoma County wildfires. Those fires are almost extinguished now, and despite the fact that about 6,000 people lost their homes, the survivors are returning to face the music and to clean up and rebuild. But Jackson Van Derbeken, a very talented reporter who used to work at the Chronicle here and now reports for NBC's local television station, he dug up a report from 2015 at the Public Utilities Commission showing that PG&E had more than 3,500 orders for repairs in a backlog in the counties of the fire zone itself. And this is just another indication of the very dangerous ineptitude of PG&E and the downright negligence that they exhibit. We've told you before about the San Bruno pipeline fire back in, I think, 2010, and that showed that PG&E didn't know where their pipelines were. Well, the 3,527 separate repair orders, including repairs to overhead lines, to transformers, and to utility poles. Well, they've got more explaining to do. Quickly, a few stories about international issues. I want to recommend a new piece by our friend Gareth Porter showing how Netanyahu of Israel has influenced Trump to the point that he's almost giving dictation regarding this trumped up, and I'm sorry for the pun, but confrontation with Iran. And he points out how Trump's speech was very similar at the United Nations to Netanyahu's, how Crown Prince Jared Kushner is the pipeline from the Likud extreme Zionists in Israel to the Trump White House, and John Bolton, who was George W. Bush's UN ambassador and a real, real dangerous man, he is back in the mix via Kushner, and also Sheldon Adelson, the other casino magnate from Las Vegas, who personally donated, he was the largest single donor to the Trump campaign, $100 million last year. So Rexxon Tillerson, the Secretary of State, dropped into Saudi Arabia, begging his oil buddies to help out with this ginned-up confrontation with Iran. And he has this wacky idea for a Saudi Arabian-Iraq Coordination Council. Now, keep in mind that Iraq is a dominant Shiite state. They share that with Iran. The Sunni minority, which was reflected by Saddam Hussein, and, of course, Sunnis run Saudi Arabia, they imagine that they can boot the Iranians out. And I don't think culturally or politically that's going to happen anytime soon. So then Rexxon made a secret trip to Afghanistan. He was there earlier today for only 2 hours, didn't even leave the hardened military base. And the New York Times writes that top American officials have to sneak into this country after 16 years of war, thousands of lives lost and hundreds of billions of dollars spent is testimony to the stalemate and the ascendance of the Taliban at the current stage. And this happened just 3 days after Friday's grisly attack on a mosque in Kabul, where 67 people were killed, and that's attributed to some elements of the Islamic State. And in a tiny, tiny, tiny article that most people will miss in my San Francisco Chronicle today, they note that the CIA is expanding its covert operations in Afghanistan, sending small teams of highly experienced officers and contractors alongside Afghan forces. Now, this is the Eric Prince idea. Privatize the war. Use mercenaries. Use contractors. That's the way to do it. And maybe he is having some influence. In Spain, Madrid did what was expected, ruthlessly and rigidly cracking down on the aspirations of independence for Catalonia, and the Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy has said that he will impose direct rule and he will bounce the Catalonian leaders who were elected in what was considered to be a fair election, but they will be gone and probably facing jail time. Meanwhile, in Prague, an anti-establishment party founded by a billionaire oligarch overpowered the Czech Republic's long-standing mainstream parties. Andrej Babiš, age 63, garnered almost 30% of the vote. And his party displaced and really marginalized the mainstream parties, the Christian Democrats and others, who have been in power since the Czech Republic became an independent government just over 25 years ago. We know that Bill O'Reilly is a sex offender. We know that Fox News paid out about $100 million to settle various cases against Bill O'Reilly. But what we didn't know is that O'Reilly had agreed to a $32 million settlement with a former Fox News analyst, Liz Wiehl, in January of this year, just moments before Fox extended him a new four-year contract at $25 million a year. And this shows that Fox had no interest in cleaning up the sexual harassment and assault scandal that led to the firing of its chairman, Roger Ailes, last August, the departure of Megyn Kelly. And to her credit, Kelly went public today attacking O'Reilly, who tried to minimize the issues related to his bad boy behavior at Fox News. And Kelly said, "That is a jaw-dropping figure, the $32 million. O.J. Simpson was ordered to pay the Goldman and Brown families $33.5 million for the murders of Ron and Nicole. So what awfulness went on?" And she tweeted, "O'Reilly's suggestion that no one ever complained about his behavior is false. I know, because I complained." And finally, my hero today, who deserves all kinds of merit badges, is a Cub Scout from Colorado named Ames Mayfield, age 11. He prepared. His Cub Scout pack was going to meet with a state senator named Vicky Marble. And so Ames Mayfield wrote down his questions, and he grilled her for 2 minutes, including, "I was shocked that you co-sponsored a bill to allow domestic violence offenders to continue to own a gun. Why on earth would you want somebody who beats their wife to have access to a gun?" And Vicky Marble, who is a pretty reliable vote for the NRA, tried to use some of those talking points. The more guns a society has, the less crime or murders are committed. But young Cub Scout Mayfield was bounced from his pack after his mother sat through an uncomfortable meeting with the Cub Scout pack leader. He communicated that my son was no longer welcome back to the den. His questions and his choice of talking about gun control was too politically charged. Well, right on, Ames Mayfield. He has been invited into another pack in his area. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. It's here every day, and it's also available on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.